From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with storyteller Minton Sparks about her upcoming show in Indianapolis.
And then I'll check out what the Sustainable Library Citizens Coalition is up to.
Plus, I'll get a preview of the Red Black exhibit at the Eideljorg, and there's our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. With a blend of music, poetry, and storytelling, Minton Sparks will walk audience members onto the front porch and portray everything Southern during Open Casket on Saturday, February 19th at 7:30 at the Frank and Katrina Basile Theater in the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center. Sharon Gamble had a chance to talk with Minton about how she came to be a storyteller and why her family is grateful she did.
Well, I have to start by asking you how you feel about being described as the potential illegitimate child of Flannery O'Connor and Hank Williams.
Yeah. Well, you know, considering who wrote it, I was kind of flattered. Marshall Chapman has a particular way of putting things that I think kind of cut to the bone.
It's very colorful.
Yeah.
Let's talk about.
I talked with her about that, and she, it's interesting because I think she sees elements of both writers in it, you know, and in the performance and in the writing.
So sure.
I like that.
About your own family, were you born to storytellers or musicians or creative folks?
I'm born to very creative folks. I mean, not as their what they do is work in the world, but you know, storytellers. All of my family, my grandparents and my aunts and uncles, and my parents.
Do you remember the first time you told a story?
You know, that's funny, the told a story, because you couldn't say lie. You know, growing up, you had to say you're telling the story. So lots of that.
ever tell one to get you out of trouble?
Sure, yes, for sure. You know, like breaking furniture and stuff and then having no idea who did it. Not furniture, but like a lamp. You know,
sure. There was a ghostly other child in the household, yes, who must have done that. That's right. At what point did you realize that, first of all, that telling these little white lies
mm-hmm.
could be something you could do for a living?
Well, I wrote poetry for years and years and years and published some in literary journals and realized that, you know, and I love literary journals, but hardly anybody reads them.
Right.
And so, and I was a narrative poet, so writing story kind of poems. And when I realized that if I put it out in the way I put it out, sort of at storytelling festivals or as a performance or on CD, you know, I have CDs and DVDs, to put it out that way, a lot more people would be able to hear it. So
mm-hmm.
that's how I started doing that. And I live in Nashville, so I got access to a lot of wonderful musicians here, you know. So.
Yeah, what's the common denominator between the spoken word and music?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think poetry is music. So the way I work is I play with John Jackson right now a lot, but I've worked with quite a number of other musicians as well. But they'll listen to sort of the story that I'm telling, and we find whatever the sound is around that. And then like one piano player said, he sort of writes a music score behind the pieces.
Hmm.
And we collaborate around the music.
Does it ever go the other way around? Somebody's playing a guitar or piano riff, and it inspires you to give a new twist, a new narrative line?
You know, that happens in the editing. So it always starts with the point. It always starts with the writing and the story for me. But when we're in the process of going back and forth with a musician, I edit a lot. because the music sort of evokes some other, you know, aspect of the story, or, you know, it brings in another emotion. So it goes back and forth in that way.
Where do you get your inspiration?
Well, so far, on my first three records, I was writing mostly about the women in my family. And my family is a lot of the stories I tell come from that. I mean, my grandfather died last year, and I remember my mom called me and said, you know, you better get over here quickly. It's a tax write-off for you. Because there was so much stuff going on. And so it's sort of, you know, reframed anything dramatic happening in the family. It feels like a good thing.
That sounds very therapeutic.
Yeah. Well, I worked as a therapist for years, too, before I did this. So.
I was going to ask you how a BA in psychology and a master's in human development counseling led into storytelling, or vice versa.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, just the whole thing, I think, of healing through listening. People are telling you their stories, and I'm just fascinated by that. You know, to get into hear other people's stories. And so, but because I have that bent, I think I sort of listen to my own family stories through that lens, you know, through sort of what's going on psychologically with the characters.
Do people in your family or friends maybe ever call on you to help them frame something and make something better of it? Something bad happened to me. I have to tell it back to me in a way that will help me make sense of it.
You know, no, but I think that's a great idea. I think I run workshops a lot, and so in the workshops, I love that because you say, you know, you change as the story you tell yourself about who you are changes.
Right.
And that, I think in that way, people tell me their stories, and then we look at, you know, sometimes find a metaphor for the actual story that happened if it's too dark or, you know, and not, for me, nothing really is too dark, so...
Say more about that. What's the darkest story you've ever told?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like different stories hit audiences as dark. I have one that's the on my record, Sin Sick. It's called Sin Sick, and it's pretty dark. You know, it's a woman who waited for this man her whole life, and he ends up killing himself, and that's pretty dark.
That's a little dark, yeah.
That's the darkest. A lot of them are really funny. You know, so there's sort of a funniness to a lot of them.
Is there a story that you've continued to tell most of your life, most of your performing years, that's continued to evolve? Or is there kind of a time when you've told a certain story enough times and now you need to tell a different one or move on and let that, put that on the back burner for a while?
Yeah. I think that each story sort of has a shelf life, and the shelf life is sort of is the emotional impact it has for me. You know, I think you literally can tell stories to death, and in a way that's a good thing. You know, so I'm still telling some stories from, you know, 12 years ago, and some of the stories from 12 years ago I'm completely finished with. So it kind of it depends on if it still has a lot of juice for me as a teller.
Do you ever change a story in the middle in front of an audience?
Mostly only if I forget it. Because my pieces are almost like songs, you know, so, and because I've worked on them so long, they're very crafted pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, if I forget something in the middle, I'll definitely make up something.
We won't know, though.
No, hopefully never know.
If you had advice for somebody who is getting started as a teller, what would you say?
You know, that's such a, it's interesting. Sort of the storytelling mecca is in East Tennessee, you know, in Jonesboro, and they have classes there. In the summertime, you can do these wonderful with sort of, you know, the best storytellers in the country. And I think people need to, to do it as much as possible. And the whole thing is this, it's an alive thing. So to throw it out into a group of people and see how it comes back to you, and then be willing to tell your stories a lot wherever you get a chance.
Do you ever have the experience of there are parts of the country where there are different storytelling styles, and maybe the way you're telling stories, people take a little bit longer to understand your style?
I definitely think the first part of that, I think people because everybody's from somewhere, and so I think where they're from comes up out of their mouth, you know. I mean, if you live in out west, and a lot of the Native American storytellers tell a certain type of story, you know, I mean, not like there's one thing, but there's a, that's kind of genre of cowboy stories. And my, I don't think that, you know, we go at, we perform everywhere, and I think people are open to that, you know, there's a universal around family. So I, don't, I think it, people can understand them everywhere, but I think each storyteller has a style.
Mm-hmm. That makes good sense. In a digital era, it feels to me like more and more people are seeking out the in-concert, in-person experience of storytellers. Do, mm-hmm. you feel, is there, is that just a, is that true? Do you feel as though people are seeking more three-dimensional connection?
You know, I think storytelling is so alive. It's theater in a way, you know, and that there's something different about storytelling in that storytelling audiences do want to be there with the teller, which is why these, you know, it's so fun to go to festivals and get to see, or go to performances where you see festivals. So I think that there is something about being right there in person with the person who's telling the story, because you get more than just the voice.
What's the story you haven't told yet that you're working on now, or that you've put away in a notebook because you're not ready for it yet?
I probably have hundreds of stories, you know, that I'm working on. I have one. I have a great uncle that's sort of a pinnacle story of a whole collection that I haven't told yet, that I'm in the middle, ooh, of working on, that I think is going to be amazing. That's.
That's cool.
But there's so many.
Does anybody in your family, because they obviously know very well what it is you do, does anybody ever start out by saying, I'm going to tell you this, but it can't show up on stage, it can't come back out of your mouth?
Hopefully I have, you know, sort of an inner governor around what's appropriate, not, although, you know, probably stepped over that. But I think people in my family call me explicitly and say, "Okay, you're going to love this one," and they come out to they come to shows, and I think they love to hear it. So I've got nothing but positive feedback from my family.
Every family should have one of you in it.
Well, maybe.
Sharon Gamble with storyteller Minton Sparks. You can hear Minton in her performance called "Open Casket" on Saturday, February 19th. At 7:30 at the Frank and Katrina Basile Theater in the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center. Here's a little sample of Minton to give you a taste.
The first time I laid eyes on Vicky Pickle's mama, she was strutting to the snack bar, a two-piece leopard print bathing suit, 10 push-ups on the concrete beside the pool, drew boys' eyes like flies. Then she orders curly fries and a Coca-Cola. Melon bosoms swim beneath her leopard skin. Red slingbacks dig dark marks in the close-cut grass. Neighbor boys beat back their pup tents in the cool pool water, praying the heads of their privates don't strain the wild floral Hawaiian fabric. The only other time I saw Ms. Pickle in that tight-fitting get-up was the day my daddy caught her sunbathing on the haunches of my quarter horse, under the cover of cottonwoods, slathering copper tone on casual like, "How's your family? Do you think we'll get a storm?"
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. In April 2010, the Indianapolis-Marion County Public Library Board announced it would close 6 library branches permanently due to the budget shortfall. Community leaders came together to stage rallies, write petitions, and fight the possible closures. This organized grassroots effort sparked the creation of the Sustainable Library Citizens Coalition. Working on behalf of the people's need for a citizens group to advocate for the public libraries, the coalition continues to advocate for the restoration and sustainability of our libraries. Travis DiNicola spoke with coalition facilitator Jim Mulholland about their work.
We'll be talking a bit about the upcoming town hall that the Citizens Library Coalition is putting on coming up very soon. But before we get into that, tell me a bit about the Sustainable Library Citizens Coalition. This really came about because of more than a year ago, I guess it's been now, my gosh, when there was first, you know, talking of shutting down branches and all of that with the public libraries and everything that's happened since then.
Yeah, this is truly a grassroots movement. It was lots of neighborhood people, specifically in the neighborhoods where those branches were going to close, who began to talk together, began to work together, And at first, the goal was simply to keep those libraries from being closed, and that was a successful effort. The library board decided to take the cuts across the board, across the system, rather than closing six libraries.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think the coalition realized that temporarily saving those branches wasn't good enough, and that's mm-hmm. when we began to organize more formally and began to look for a long-term sustainable solution.
Well, the result that we have right now is a schedule that does keep all the branches open, but admittedly, for some people, it's a very confusing schedule with sort of rolling closing dates. One library might be open on a Tuesday, another on Wednesday, what have you. You know, and ideally, we'd like to get back to a place where the libraries, all the libraries are open all the time. If you can, give me a little background, though, on sort of why this happened or how this happened, because I think some people get a bit confused as far as understanding why the library doesn't have the money to keep their doors open at the hours that we'd like to see. And also, you know, in a sense, the library is not the enemy here.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was in some ways a perfect storm. I mean, there was the debt that was caused by the building, the new building, when the economy
sure.
was strong.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was the recession that came along, and then, of course, the decision to cap property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
The combinations of those three things seriously decreased the revenues that were available for library services, and the library was dependent on largely 85% on property tax, so
right.
It simply came down to there not being the dollars and
mm-hmm.
the library being forced to make some serious cuts, and then people, I think, becoming aware of how important those libraries are to our city and to the quality of life.
Right, and again, just to stress this, it wasn't as though the library's budget was cut by somebody saying we don't want to give money to the libraries. It was that because of the property tax cap, there was just less money available based on the current formula we have.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And so what is... of course, you know, as we said, you know, one result of that is that the libraries have less hours now. They've also reduced their budget in terms of acquisitions of new books. They also have fewer staff now as well. And I know I've been working with a group from the mayor's office to become more sustainable and sort of leaner and more efficient. It's an efficiency group. But yet there's still it's still not enough.
Correct. Yeah, I think the library has done a good job at trying to be as lean as they possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there have been some creative solutions for cutting that budget. But as with a lot of our services right now, I think the crunch is that all of us want quality services, and we also want low taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to reconcile.
Yes,
you know?
It is.
And... So one of the solutions we're looking at right now is
mm-hmm.
to move the library to receive a part of the county income tax. So in other words, we're going to use tax money
mm-hmm.
to continue to support the libraries, but it won't be completely reliant on property taxes.
Okay.
And we think that's sustainable because when you have multiple sources of income, then if there is a decrease in one, you're able to sustain it with the dollars you have from somewhere else. But as it
mm-hmm.
is, libraries have been almost totally dependent upon property taxes.
Now, with being able to access essentially the income tax, that is not an increase on that tax. It just means being able to use some of those funds, correct?
Right. We're in a very odd situation. Marion County is the only county in the state of Indiana that is by statute not allowed
mm-hmm.
to use its county income tax for libraries.
Hmm.
Now, there are some who will argue with that, but
mm-hmm.
Essentially that
okay.
seems to be what the situation is. In fact, the state legislature is actually considering a bill that would change that and give the city-county council clear authority to use county income tax for library operating expenses. So what we're hoping is
mm-hmm.
that then those dollars can be redistributed,
mm-hmm.
and there would have to be some of that, but that would then allow the library to return to full service.
Now let me ask you this. If that was possible, and being able to bring the library back to a budget that allows them at full service, or maybe even leaner but still with the same hours that they had before, do you have a sense of what would be then sacrificed otherwise? Because if the taxes aren't being increased, you know, for the income tax, but they would be able to pull some of that for the library, is there something else that we'd be sacrificing, essentially, or do we know that at this point?
We don't know that. Obviously, there would have to be some hard decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the negative things about the dynamics right now is we're pitting a lot of good things against each other. I mean, whether it's transportation or education or public safety or libraries. And we all, I think none of us would want to see any of those things diminished.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have to make some hard decisions. And I think there are many of us who think that libraries are of such importance, not only to the quality of life, but to the economic development of our city. I think what people have forgotten is because of the internet, because of computers, libraries are no longer just about books.
Mm-hmm.
Libraries are an access point for a lot of people into that computer world, that internet world, that's almost a necessity if you're going to be successful economically. So,
And they're really one of the few public spaces that people can gather in for free. And
that's right.
You know, not just access books and information over the internet, but just have a place to sit down inside and read or what have you.
Yeah, there's thousands of groups, literally thousands of groups in the city of Indianapolis that meet in library space. It has that sense of being a place where community comes together.
So if the Sustainable Library Citizens Coalition is successful in getting and again, I know this is very technical, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but if it's successful in getting the City County Council to essentially agree to allow the library to tap into that income revenues from income, that's really just opening the door for the next discussion as far as how much or how that works?
Right, the City County Council would still have to decide what percentage, and that would be something that we hope citizens can have a input into that mm-hmm. Discussion about what is valued and how do we balance that all out. Part of what we're excited about is on this upcoming Tuesday, February 8th,
let's talk about that.
There's
mm-hmm.
going to be a town hall meeting where many of the politicians who have been working on this are going to be there to talk about some of the solutions that are being formulated and some of the long-term possibilities, and to give the public an opportunity just to talk about why they do value the libraries mm-hmm. and why that needs to be given special consideration.
And there are certainly other solutions on the table as well. And one I've heard about is, you know, possibly using some of the money from the townships to be able to support the libraries. The coalition isn't necessarily backing just one solution, right? It's essentially you're looking for a solution.
Exactly. I mean, we're certainly not financial experts. We're certainly not saying that there's one solution supported by one political party, but we are saying that when it comes to the library services, that really should be a nonpartisan issue. It really ought to be something that, as just citizens here in this great city, that we want to make certain that library access is equitable and is available. We're not saying that there has to be a specific solution. One of the discussions has been about the possibility of giving libraries referendum mm-hmm. authority. There's just a variety of things out there. But the bottom line is, if we don't find dollars mm-hmm. to help return the library to full service, then not only are we going to have to accept this lower level of service, but there's some real question about whether in the next few years we'll even see those services diminished in greater ways. Right now, the library system that in 2009 was the library system, best library system in the whole nation, which was in Queens, New York, is essentially shutting down. So we don't want to find ourselves in a situation where someday all of those buildings are empty.
Now, I have heard our library system compared very favorably to other library systems, at least in terms of the services they provide. Have you seen, I mean, obviously it didn't work in Queens, but have you seen examples in other cities where they've essentially been able to successfully save their libraries?
This is not just an issue here in Indianapolis or just in Indiana. It's a nationwide issue. Terre Haute just recently closed all of their branches except for their central mm-hmm. Location. So I think across the nation, we're having to kind of decide what is valuable, where do we spend our dollars, what do we think is an essential community service. So I think there's lots of people across the nation working on this. I guess the good news is I think Indianapolis is one of the few places where citizens have taken such an active role in being part of the solution, and I'm proud of that.
Well, and certainly there's a very active group of people behind this. I do want to mention the great website, My Indie Library, where you can get more information. Also, of course, as you mentioned, the town hall that's coming up on Tuesday the 8th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Madam Walker Theater Center. You do not need to RSVP for that. You can just show up.
Absolutely.
Stuff. And you mentioned there'll be a number of speakers, local politicians, basically sort of reviewing what's been going on and different options.
Correct. There'll be state and county politicians there, as well as some experts that can kind of put everything in context. And then we're hoping for just a very healthy conversation about what are the next steps and perhaps beginning to talk about that whole issue of value. You know, why is the library valuable, and how do we balance its value with other valuable things? You know, one of the interesting discussions I recently had with one of our IMPD commanders was, does a library have a public safety contribution? And he clearly said, well, of course it does, and was able to list several ways in which libraries have a positive public safety contribution.
And make the community a better place.
Correct.
And if that's something that that you care about and you believe, as do I, then certainly show up at the Madam Walker at 6:30 on Tuesday night to learn more and to lend your voice to this. So, Jim, thank you very much for coming in today, and best of luck with the work that you're doing with Sustainable Library Citizens Coalition.
Thanks, Travis. Thanks for the time.
Travis DiNicola with Jim Mulholland from the Sustainable Library Citizens Coalition. They're hosting a town hall meeting on Tuesday, February 8th, from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Madam Walker Center. For more information, visit myindielibrary.org. Again, that town hall meeting coming up on Tuesday the 8th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Madam Walker Center. And for more information, go to myindielibrary.org. Hey, Travis, do you have a cup of coffee?
Sure, Sharon.
Good, because I have a bag of conversation hearts to go with your coffee right here.
Aren't you clever?
Them up a little bit.
Getting all ready for Valentine's.
Here's one that says, buy me a painting.
Really? They fit painting on that little conversation heart?
Well, you have to flip it over. It's hyphenated.
That's fantastic.
We dig deeper into this bag of special Teotum conversation hearts, that we'll find some things for you to do with your sweetheart on that calendar we call.
What do we do? I do have some Valentine's Day's ideas coming up that I do want to mention. But before I get into that, I want to talk about an event that's going on this weekend that is really fantastic. And I also need to clarify a little bit of information about it. This is the Youth America Grand Prix, which is a ballet competition that the Indianapolis City Ballet has brought to Indianapolis. And I want to be clear that the Indianapolis City Ballet is the sole sponsor of the Indianapolis semifinals of the Youth America Grand Prix. And in fact, the City Ballet and Kevin Hess and their group of people, the Indianapolis City Ballet, has made it possible to bring this event to Indianapolis after over 18 months of collaborative efforts with the founders of the Youth America Grand Prix, which is very cool. Now, there are some other organizations working with them, including Ballet Theater of Carmel, which is hosting the educational component of the competition that they're doing on by hosting the YAGP's masterclasses at their studios on Old Meridian Street. But Indianapolis City Ballet is bringing it this weekend. It's taking place in Zionsville on Saturday and Sunday, and it's a whole series of ballet competitions, which is just very, very exciting. They're bringing people from literally all over the world for this, as well as some local competitors as well. If you want more information about it, because you can, it's too late to register to compete, but you can certainly go and watch the competition for the YAGP. Go to IndianapolisCityBallet.org. Again, IndianapolisCityBallet.org to find out more information about this. Very cool thing. And it will be at the Zionsville Community High School this weekend.
Very good. Hey, you know, sometimes we all need a little help from an artistic Cupid. And there is one online. If you go to visitindiana.com right now, you can get a number of suggestions for things to do with or for your Valentine.
many of which involve the arts or cultural tourism. For example, you can relax in a rustic setting at the Fort Harrison State Park Inn here in Indianapolis with a package that includes overnight accommodations, in-room gift, and Sunday brunch. And weather permitting, you can go for a nice hike at the park there. Or there's a package at the New Harmony Inn that includes overnight accommodations, dinner at Red Geranium, and, as they say, much, much more. Another suggestion, fly your sweetie to the moon at the Challenger Learning Center in Hammond, or listen to love songs with Everett Green at the Indiana History Center here in Indianapolis.
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. They're all good. Replace roses with a trip to Orchid Escape at Mesker Park Zoo and Botanical Garden in Evansville. Hmm. So lots more ideas at visitindiana.com. Visitindiana.com. So if you're looking for a little getaway, but you want to make it a one-tank trip, that's a good place to go for suggestions.
That's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Something a little bit closer to home if you're looking to perhaps make a unique gift for your Valentine.
Oh, I know what this is.
Mm-hmm. Up at the Indianapolis Arts Center, they are again having their workshops to make gifts for your sweetie, including make your own glass heart, not a heart that you want to break, but a very beautiful glass heart that you can make on Sunday, February 13th. From 3 to 5, this is for ages 10 and up, and you actually get to make your own glass heart working with the glass blowers there, and they're a 2,000-degree furnace, and you get to scoop out your own glowing, molten glass and make a little heart out of it that you can give to your parents or your kids or your loved one or what have you. It should be a ton of fun. You do need to register for these classes, okay? They do fill up very, very quickly, so you want to give the Indianapolis Arts Center a call at 255-2464 for that class, but they're also doing some jewelry workshops as well for Valentine's, where you can make some jewelry for your sweetie. But the one that I think I really want to go to is the Make Your Own Glass Heart.
Soundtrack by Blondie, not included.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, I have a road trip that you can do with your sweetheart.
No, I got that song in my head.
I know, right? And it's irritating. You can sip local wine and sample decadent desserts along the Indy Wine Trail and the Indiana Uplands Wine Trail. Both of those trails, which between the two of them total 15 wineries, will host Chocolate Lovers Weekends this month.
Ooh.
So chocolate and wine, boy, you can't beat that. So you can check out Uplands Wine Trail or Indy Wine Trail and find out more about that.
Two of the basic food groups.
Chocolate and wine. I love it.
Okay, so this is a little confusing, but Sharon, have you heard about...
Oh, no, not another confusing thing on
Basile
the same calendar.
Basile et Basile. Have you heard about this?
Oh, I know what this is about, yes.
Okay, the Indianapolis Opera is hosting the award-winning actress Celeste Holm, and this is in partnership with Heartland Truly Moving Pictures, and they're doing Basile et Basile. It's an evening of music and film featuring a presentation of the Career Advancement Award to Academy Award-winning actress Celeste Holm. It will also include the song stylings of Holmes' husband, who is named Frank Basile. Now, this is taking place at the Frank and Katrina Basile space. Now, these are not the same Frank Basiles. There are two Frank Basiles. One is our wonderful local philanthropist, and the other is married to Celeste Holm. And Katrina knows nothing about that one, I'm sure. This is very confusing. But anyway, the idea is Basile at Basile, or maybe it should be at the Basile Opera Center. And you can get more information at indieopera.org. I'm sure they probably have pictures of both gentlemen posted, so you can tell them apart.
If you run into, quote-unquote, our Frank Basile, ask him the story about discovering the singer Frank Basile.
That's right. Yeah. That's a good
one. Hey, the Indiana Art Fair, that's the indoor version of an art fair, is coming up very soon, Friday the 18th, Saturday the 19th, and Sunday the 20th at the Indiana State Museum. And speaking of glass, I actually purchased a beautiful glass necklace last time I went to that a couple of years ago. There are more than 75 artists, all the way from painting to photography to fiber art, sculpture, jewelry. And it's indoors at the Indiana State Museum, so picture Penrod, but indoors out of the nasty weather that you find this time of year. And again, that's coming up on the 18th from 6 to 8 p.m., the 19th from 10 to 5, and the 20th from 11 to 5 at the Indiana State Museum.
That sounds great. Hey, something to warm you up this weekend. On Saturday night, two concerts at the Jazz Kitchen, one at 7 and one at 10 p.m. Gary Walters, great jazz pianist, is getting together, and he's going going to be featuring Matt Pivick on saxophone, Rich Dole on trombone, Jesse Whitman on bass, excuse me, and they brought
a
fisherman
too,
and John Crabill on drums. They're doing two sets with no fish, and what caught my attention is that when Gary sent me an email about this, he said, and as the late, great Chuck Carter used to say, someone is going to set their hair on fire before the night is over. That sounds like a hot jazz concert.
It does indeed. And by the way, there's a nice menu there. I don't know if bass will be on it that night, but try the chicken Caesar salad. That's my standby there. Frugal and Fancy, if your sweetheart likes quilts, take him or her to Frugal and Fancy Indiana Quilts. Frugal and Fancy quilting traditions merged in the New World when the formal needlework tradition of the European elite met the more informal Scots-Irish tradition of scrap or strip quilts. So if you don't know the vocabulary of quilts, this is a great exhibition to go check out. That's also at the Indiana State Museum, opening February 12th and up for several months. So you have many chances, but hey, make a Valentine's outing of it. Why not?
That sounds absolutely lovely.
If you are listening on Friday night, we might still be running into you at if you happen to be at Gallery
Fridays.
924. Yeah, but I'm especially drawn to Doug Kalish's The Biography of Objects, which will look the works will look to you a lot like what you might have seen under a microscope in your biology or botany class. It's called The Biography of Objects, and it opens this Friday night, the fourth.
Mm-hmm.
This Friday is the 4th. Saturday is the 5th. And it is at Gallery 924 at the Arts Council through the 25th.
Very good. Well, Sharon, we'll have more ideas for things you can do with your sweetie for Valentine's Day, and we'll keep checking in with those conversation hearts next week on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
A groundbreaking exhibition exploring the shared history between African and Native Americans will open at the Idle George Museum on Saturday, February 12th. It's called Red Black, Related Through History, and it includes an object-based exhibition on the subject created by the Idle George Museum and the Smithsonian's traveling panel show, Indivisible, African Native American Lives in the Americas. Sharon Gamble invited James Nottage, Chief Curatorial Officer of the Idle Jorg, into our studios to learn more.
So I know that the Idle Jorg has been somewhat of a pioneer in this area of researching the history of relations between African and Native Americans. Is that correct? How did that get started?
It began in 2001 with an NEH grant where we began dialogue with scholars in the field, and we've explored the subject now for 10 years. So with some small exhibits leading up to the big show here.
It's something that I don't remember hearing anything about in school, and it may not have even made it into history classes yet, but it seems to me that there might be a lot of opportunity for both conflict and collaboration, yeah?
Absolutely so, and it's a tough subject to deal with, but as someone might imagine, the story begins with the first arrival of African people on the shores of North America. A lot of the story is tied to ideas of slavery. Native Americans were enslaved. Of course, most African Americans came to the New World as slaves. But what they don't know is that part of the story is that Native Americans held African slaves. So there was a point of conflict there, but there was also cooperation, fighting alongside one another against the U.S. during the Seminole Wars. It's a very complex and very interesting subject.
Wow. The exhibition that you're about to open really is two exhibitions. One that's a so-called object-based exhibition that you've developed, you
right.
being the Idle Jorg, and the other is a Smithsonian traveling show. What is a panel show? That's what the Smithsonian show is.
Well, the Smithsonian show is entitled Indivisible, and it's an exhibit they developed on literally on panels. There are no original art or artifacts, but it has words and graphics that tell the story. And it was created for tribal centers and public libraries. But it has some wonderful information. They have a terrific video that's part of the show. And we've sort of incorporated that in our exhibit that looks at the subjects more deeply and incorporates real artifacts, real works of art, and tells the story really from early contact to today.
I have what's probably a naive question, but when you're developing an artifact exhibit, how do you start? Do you start by brainstorming and saying, gosh, how would we tell this story? It would be ideal if we had a peace treaty between two communities, or do you start by saying what's out there and tailor the story to what you can put your hands on?
It's more the latter. It's really getting a good hold of what's the history. And then as you discover that history, you certainly watch for physical expressions of that. And part of this story is lost because it's not deeply documented, but part of it is told through artifacts. For example, you see shared history in music. You see shared history in food preparation objects, shared traditions in foods. You find really interesting things. So Gullah people in Carolinas who brought rice culture to the New World, were enslaved and brought to the New World, shared that rice culture with Native American people and brought their basket traditions to the New World. And Native people shared their traditions in clothing and basket making and pottery making with African people. So you look for the evidence. Where did these contexts first show up? So we go to archaeology and we find interesting examples of pottery created as these groups connect with each other that include African and Native traditions. You just look where the evidence takes you.
What are some of the milestones in this history?
Well, certainly one of the main milestones has to do with slavery and the period up to the 1830s when African slaves flee plantations in Carolinas and Virginia and Georgia and head for Florida. There they find some protection from the Spanish government in a way. There are African communities in Florida up until the late 1700s. They find create communities and live among the Seminole people who live together peaceably with them, but also become slave owners themselves later on. So one of those milestones is the Florida story and the story of the Seminole and the escaped slaves.
And this story, it strikes me, goes pretty far into the 20th century.
It comes up to right now, in fact, just this week. And of course, we're talking at this taping at the end of January, uh-huh. But the Cherokee tribe, there was a court case in the Cherokee court system. They had earlier taken freedmen, former slaves, who were members of the tribe in the 19th century. They had been forced out of the tribe, and just this week a court case brought them back in.
Really?
So it's a constant and important part of the lives of a lot of these people.
There are some particular stories that caught my attention. One is the story of a woman named Lucinda Davis. How did you learn about her, and what's her history?
Well, Lucinda is one of a number of people. In the 1930s, during the Roosevelt administration, there were programs, the Works Progress Administration, that financed historians all over the country interviewing pioneers and recording state and local history. And in Oklahoma, a number of those interviews were with former slaves who were owned by American Indians. And Lucinda is one of those people. When guests come to our exhibit, we're using acting talent here in Indianapolis mm-hmm. to provide voices and take those written accounts and bring them to life. So Lucinda tells you about her experiences, and she's one of a number that we're including.
Wow. And then there's a famous Baltimore Orioles member.
And I'm going to be terrible about remembering names, but we all grow up hearing about the color barrier being broken in the 1950s mm-hmm. and the first black player becoming a part of the National Leagues. But really it began with the Baltimore Orioles just after 1900 when a black player is passed off as an American Indian, essentially, and plays with the Baltimore Orioles. So a couple of generations before we heard about them.
fascinating, and just the permutations of race relations and prejudice that have to be evident through all this history.
And that's easily the most important thing about this exhibit. That's what we want all of our visitors to go away with. And that's questioning ideas of race.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at other people, we judge who or what they are by mm-hmm. the color of their skin or the shapes of their faces. And this exhibit really defies those presumptions and allows us to ask the question about who has the right to say who or what someone else is.
Mm-hmm.
And we want people to think about that.
What are some of your favorite artifacts that are in the exhibit you've developed?
Well, one of my favorites is a group of objects related to the life story of a young woman named Radmila Cody, who in 1998 was elected Miss Navajo Nation. Radmila's father is African, her mother is Navajo, and she was raised by a traditional Navajo grandmother. She speaks the language, she raised sheep, she weaves blankets, she lived a Navajo life. But when she was elected, there was a lot of controversy within the Navajo nation about whether that was appropriate. And so in our exhibit, we have her crown, we have her sash and her dress, and we'll actually have Radmila performing at the museum. She's a singer, and she'll be at the museum later in the summer. But hers is a poignant story that helps to point out a lot of these issues.
You do have a lot of programming that that's appropriate for the whole family. And what are some of the highlights of your programming that go along with Red Black?
Well, for the big opening day on February 12th, there's a lot going on. We have African drum groups. We have Native drum and dance groups. You see a lot of sharing in music as well.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, some of the songs we're used to, like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, that actually comes from a Native American translation.
Really?
We'll learn a lot about that. Families, there will be storytelling. There will be a range of performers, including a performer who's African Native, who's playing jazz music. I mentioned Radmila. She'll be with us on March 19th. And so there's a lot going on just about every weekend.
What I know you have a genealogy day that on May 21st where you can learn how to research your family history and find out more. Do we have any sense of Indiana's heritage in particular? I realize that you do programming on a national scope, but I'm just curious. Indiana obviously got its name because of the density of Native American population, but do you have much sense of the shared culture between African and Native Americans in Indiana?
Well, we do. We know that there was a trader in very early Indiana history who was African, but up to today, there are many people who, of course, have immigrated here from all over the country, but many members of the African-American community who claim American Indian heritage. And that's part of the reason for the genealogy day, because a lot of people simply want to know how to discover their own history and background.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll be working with a number of experts in researching both Native American and African-American family history.
What surprised you in the research most?
Oh, what surprised me? I think maybe one of the things that surprised me had less to do with the history than how strongly people feel about the history. Some of this story has African Americans serving as soldiers in the West, the so-called Buffalo Soldiers, fighting against Indians. And that has a set of emotions that are negative and still with many Native people. There are emotions about the slavery issues that it helps to remind us that history isn't just a cold thing of the past. It's something that's important today, and understanding the past helps us to have a better grasp of our lives today.
What is the future of the artifact exhibit? Do you have some tour dates lined up for it?
We are not traveling that show, and I think one of the primary reason is that the objects are so scattered and they're so difficult to draw together.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there is a plantation in Georgia, the Van Plantation. James Van was a Cherokee slave owner. One of the pieces in the show is a Cherokee slave-made basket.
Hmm.
And they sacrificed a lot to take that out of their own exhibits to make it available to us.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those objects are also very light sensitive. So it's a challenge to get pieces that owners will allow to travel.
Sure. Who else in the country or the world is working in this particular area?
Well, that's actually one of the most rewarding things, not because of us at all, but during the last 15 years, there's been a huge growth in the exploration of this topic. So the numbers of books that have been published in the last 15 years is thrilling. Really important volumes by scholars who are examining this subject. It is appearing more frequently on campuses. It's being discussed more openly. And we're sort of rediscovering the past, as it were.
Is there an umbrella term for this field of study? Is it Afro-Native American studies, or are we not to the point of having a kind of an umbrella term yet?
Well, I'm not sure there is a good umbrella term, but it's really a part of the larger world of studying race relations, cultural history, and its complexities in the American experience. So we'll see scholars working in the field of diaspora story history, and scholars in American Indian studies and anthropology. It reaches pretty deeply.
Sharon Gamble with James Nottage, Chief Curatorial Officer of the Eiteljorg. Red Black, Related Through History, opens Saturday, February 12th and runs through August 9th. There's lots of special programming going on as well. You can learn more about it at eiteljorg.org. That's EITELJORG.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 when I'll chat with photographer John Gentry.
I'll find out about Meet the Artists at the Indianapolis Marion County Central Library.
And for Valentine's, I'll talk with a couple who are married to magic. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Will We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.